You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast. Brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Well, hello again, and welcome to the Cycling Podcast. My name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney in Not Watford.
Hello, Richard.
How is Not Watford, Lionel?
Well, the weather today has been pretty changeable. Had a torrential hailstorm when I was doing my Zwift ride with Rob Hatch earlier on.
A little sneaky Zwift ride with Rob Hatch, eh?
Yeah. Yeah, well, he's finished his commentary duties for Eurosport. Now the Giro is over, and he's watching the Vuelta on TV, and so we met up on Zwift, a virtual meetup.
Interesting. Maybe I'll do a Zwift ride with Rob Hatch one day. And Francois Tomaso. Hello, Francois.
Are you there?
That sounds like a dig, Rich.
And I just mildly perturbed I wasn't invited to the Zwift ride, but, you know, it's fine. I'll get over it. I had a lovely ride out in the countryside today.
So there you are.
Nice. Yeah.
Would you like to join? Would you like to join us on Friday?
No, I can't. I'm busy. Lionel, you've been busy carving your pumpkin.
I have,
as well.
Yeah.
That's not a euphemism for anything.
Halloween is coming up. I never really gave Halloween much of a. It was always a sort of evening of pretending not to be in and never having treats for trick or treaters.
But with a
2-year-old, I thought she'd quite like to see your giant pumpkin, Richard, which your wife very kindly gave to me to bring home for when I dropped you off after the Tour de France. The pumpkin has survived that long, and I took a knife to it this morning and carved a smiley face into it, and my daughter was delighted to see the pumpkin all lit up when she was dropped back by her grandparents this evening. But there we are. There's a little vignette from Not Watford.
Lovely. Francois, how's life in Marseille?
Well, life in Marseille is, you know, it's kind of a suspense, I guess, the same as you are, Richard, being a Frenchman now, sort of.
We're
waiting for, you know, we're not waiting for kids to, you know, ring the bell at our doors and bring in sweets. We're waiting for the French president to announce we're going in lockdown again. So it's kind of, it's kind of an horror night ahead, but a little bit different, I guess. Weather was absolutely perfect today. Very warm. Probably 24 or 25 or something. So can't complain.
Well, but you've probably got a glass of rosé on the go, Francois, and you're ready to. Well, we're in Rioja today, weren't we?
Yeah.
In Spain at the Vuelta, and another really interesting action-packed stage. Without the sort of unpredictable twists that we had yesterday, perhaps it was a kind of conventional mountain finish, and we really saw the cream rise to the top. Can you give us the headlines, please, Lionel?
I can, Richard. Yeah, you mentioned Rioja. Yeah, very much the Rioja stage, from the capital of the Rioja region, Logroño, to Moncalvillo. And Logroño was where Chris Froome won a time trial in 2017 on his way to winning the Vuelta itself, and it was where I started my final stint of the Vuelta that year. And it was a fantastic town. When the world does get back to normal and we can all travel, if you're in the region, I'd recommend a trip to Logroño. There's a little street, narrow street, called Calle Laurel, which is just lined with little bars selling tapas or pinchos and all the different Riojas and other drinks too, and real kind of bustling atmosphere. And I felt quite wistful today, thinking back to that and realizing that, you know, really across Europe we can't do that. We can't have a little glass of wine stood outside socializing after watching the stage, especially not in Rioja, because Rob Hatch was telling me on our secret Zwift bike ride earlier today that it's one of the regions, an increasing number of regions in Spain, where all non-essential travel is now being stopped. And if you're not from the Rioja region, you can't travel in if unless it's for work or a sort of medical,
or as part of the Vuelta,
or as part of the Vuelta. But of course, the Vuelta and other major sports events do have dispensations for this. But clearly, the situation is worsening in Spain and elsewhere. So we'll keep our eyes on that. But the race itself, as you say, Richard, as fairly straightforward mountain stage, big climb in the middle of the stage, and then the climb up to the finish at the Alto de Moncalvillo. We set off this morning. Well, we didn't. I didn't set off this morning. The race set off this morning without Tom Dumoulin. The Jumbo-Visma rider's been a bit out of sorts since the start of the race, and he was a non-starter, as were Kenny Ellison of Trek Segafredo and Michal Goash of Ineos Grenadiers. So Richard Carapaz has lost a helper there, so they're down two riders now, Ineos Grenadiers. Anyway, there was a break, and in it were Rui Costa of UAE Team Emirates, and Angel Madrazo of Burgos BH, Rob Stannard of Mitchelton Scott, or Stannard, I think, is the Australian pronunciation. I'll say both to cover the bases there. Remy Cavagna of De Koenig Quickstep, two Lotto Soudal riders, Stan De Wolf and Tosh van der Sander, and Ben Dibble of NTT Pro Cycling. On that big climb in the middle of the stage, two Caja Rural riders tried to go across to the break because it was just about within reach, but they didn't get very far. And as we got towards the top of the climb, Movistar went to the front and started chasing pretty hard on the climb and then on the descent as well. And they really brought the break under control. De Wolf and Dibble went clear of the break, and they lasted a little bit longer than the rest. And then the final 6.5 or so kilometres really were action-packed. First of all, we saw Alejandro Valverde accelerating. Presumably that was why Movistar were making it so hard on the final part of the previous climb. We saw Mike Woods, yesterday's stage winner, working very hard for his EF Pro Cycling teammate Hugh Carthy. And when Woods peeled off with about 3.5k to go, Carthy put in an attack with Sepp Kuss marking for Primoz Roglic. Carthy looked pretty good for a little while, and that really kicked off the final part of the stage, and there were all sorts of moves going. Dan Martin went across, Alexander Vlasov of Astana went across, and we saw riders such as Grosschartner and Chavez getting dropped. With about 2.5 to go, Kuss and Carthy were caught, and then it was the Carapaz and Roglic show, wasn't it? The pair of them really trading blows in that final 2.5 kilometres. At one point they were up the road and Carthy went across to them, so he wasn't out of it. And then the final denouement of the stage was when Vlasov went, and it looked like the GC riders were going to just let him go and take the stage because they didn't necessarily have to chase him for the GC battle. But Roglic looked absolutely fantastic, and he countered, caught Vlasov, and then it was, as I say, Carapaz versus Roglic in that final kilometre, and Roglic came out on top. And when all said and done, he has cut his deficit to Carapaz from 30 seconds, as it was this morning, to 13 seconds. So Roglic won the stage, Carapaz remains in the red jersey, Hugh Carthy sort of gambled and lost a little bit, so he has slipped down from second to fourth. But nevertheless, a very aggressive ride from him on the final climb. And, well, we'll talk about what this indicates with the Angliru coming up at the weekend and another very difficult stage on Saturday as well. But I was kind of sensing last night that you thought, Richard, that Roglic was maybe fading a little bit, and today he came blasting back.
You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iWalker.co.uk. iWOCA.co.uk.
We heard last night from Liv Denyer of iWalker about iWalker Pay. Let's hear from her again. This time she's explaining precisely how the facility works and can benefit your small or medium-sized business.
So the way that iWalker Pay works is a supplier of some kind will send a link to their customer along with an invoice. That customer can then sign up to iWalker Pay and get some credit to cover that invoice. iWalker Pay pays the seller directly, and then their customer gets up to 3 months to pay iWalker back. So they get the flexibility and the control over their cash flow to take a little bit longer to pay, but the supplier gets paid upfront in full and doesn't have to worry about chasing the invoice or the risk that they're not going to get paid. And we've managed to onboard quite a lot of businesses and get them using iWalker Pay. There was definitely a few moments in the middle of the pandemic when small businesses weren't working, where we weren't sure whether we were going to be able to meet our goals and kind of gain any traction with the product. But luckily, as businesses have been opening their doors again, they've seen a real need for something like this, and they're really interested in changing the way that their payment process works. So we've definitely seen a lot of interest in the product.
As I said last night, iWalker is a company that really has an interest in cycling at its heart. And recently, Liv and some of her colleagues organised a charity bike ride to benefit the Stephen Lawrence Charitable Trust. And from tomorrow, we'll hear a bit about that. But if you would like to find out more about iWalker, go to iwoca.co.uk.
Well, you sensed, Lionel, that I thought Roglic was fading. I'm not sure I did sense that, and I'm not sure I said that. I think what I thought was that, and I think Francois said this as well, that we thought after a couple of days that the Vuelta would be, if not a cakewalk, then certainly Roglic and Jumbo Visma were in the driving seat. And then after the stage a few days ago, when there was that awful weather and Roglic struggled with his rain jacket and lost a bit of time, I didn't feel that he was in the driving seat anymore. But I didn't feel like he was necessarily out of it. You know, I think he just had a bad day. And I did say that I thought this Vuelta would be open to, you know, ambushes and things like that. I think it'll be hard, and he's lost Dumoulin now as well. His team Jumbo-Visma don't seem as strong as they were at the Tour de France, which George Bennett sort of hinted at when we spoke to him on the eve of the race. You know, I don't see any Ineos Grenadiers have lost another rider as well. Those two teams really have to, you know, to a greater or lesser extent, one card to play: Roglic and Carapaz. Sepp Kuss is still, he's 10 minutes down now, Kuss, so he's a bit of a long shot. And I think there is a possibility of an ambush on one day. I was very impressed by Movistar until the climb up to the finish, when it seemed that they had effectively taken two of their riders out of contention. Marc Soler and Alejandro Valverde both lost. You know, they were both pretty close last night, and they're a little bit further away tonight. And I don't know if it was all for Enric Mas today, but Mas also lost a little bit today. So it was a show of strength from Movistar, but it didn't really work in their favour in the end, did it?
Well, maybe a show of weakness. I mean, it kind of confirms my theory, or my, you know, just appraisal that team tactics are different in this strange season, because obviously it's not the first time we see a team leading throughout a stage, like I think Bora Hansgrohe did during the Tour de France and a couple of others, and you seem in the old days that there was a way to do it. You pull, and in the end your leader goes and you've done it. But we haven't seen that very much this season in any Grand Tour. Every time a team has been trying to do that, they actually seem to have, you know, faltered at the end and you know, lost their energy because the Movistar effort today was maybe a little bit too early. And in the end, as you said, neither Valverde or Mas or Soler was in a state to go for it. So yeah, we have the impression now that the most Grand Tours, at least the Giro, showed that, and the Vuelta is showing it now. It's much earlier on a man-to-man fight, and that's the way I think Richard Carapaz described the last climb, you know, finale today, calling it a mano a mano. And maybe it's more a matter of individuals, and you need not a whole team behind you. I mean, they do their job in the early part of the stage, but you need one guy with you. And today, maybe my little disappointment today was Sepp Kuss. He's been flying, you know, in the mountains this season, and he was a little bit below par, I found, today.
It's funny looking at GC. I mean, George Bennett is 12. He's got 6 minutes on Sepp Kuss, and Kuss has been so sort of visible on these mountain stages. It's kind of surprising to see that. I mean, I think that Movistar still have options there, and I think, as you know, Carapaz said, it was mano a mano. That's not when they will necessarily do well. It is, you know, with Alejandro Valverde, Marc Soler, and Enric Mas, three riders in the top 10. Later on in the race, on a stage that might look quite innocuous, if one of those guys gets in a break and it gets time, and you know, Ineos Grenadiers are not willing or not able to control it, and Jumbo Visma leave it to Ineos Grenadiers, and we could have a situation where, you know, one of those guys finds himself in the race lead. They're not that far off, but on the big stages like the Angliru, they will lose, I think, more time.
Well, I mean, we had the impression, you know, after the first couple of stages that the GC was already decided in a way, and we said yesterday it was not the case. But if you look at, if I get it right, and don't have the GC in front of my eyes, but I think the top four are still battling out for the GC, and the fifth is 1:54 down, which is nearly 2 minutes. So my impression is that the fight for the battle for the GC is already reduced to these four guys in the front, in my opinion.
The one thing I'd say about that, though, with Mass being that fifth rider, 1:54 down, is that his big breakthrough Grand Tour was the Vuelta 2 years ago, mm-hmm. 2018, when you know, he was sort of hovering around just outside the top 10 until the last week, really, and he kept moving up in the final week, and then moved up to second place on that penultimate stage in Andorra. So he may well come good in the final week of the race. And, well, looking at it, I think that all the top five have ridden the Tour this season, haven't they?
Yeah, that's right. And maybe there's a way to do it in such a tight season. We could have thought that maybe Roglic, as you didn't say, Richard, was, or and as I didn't say either, was kind of faltering. He showed today he wasn't. And maybe the third week, as you say, will be crucial. But still, but the impression you have in the mountain stage is that there's lots on this Vuelta, seven mountain top finishes, I think. Still, I can't see how Roglic, Carapaz, and Dan Martin, who's going very well, are going to lose their mountain flair totally in the third week. It's still, you know, pretty much obvious to me that these guys, well, the winner of this Vuelta is among these guys. Maybe you, Carty, but I'm maybe a little bit down from the other three, I think.
Just on that, Lionel, you actually go down the list. It's the top 14 on GC all rode the Tour de France, as far as from memory. I think all those guys rode the Tour de France. Not sure they all finished, but they were all there. So that is an interesting little observation, isn't it? Mikel Nieve didn't finish the Tour, but I think most of them did.
I even thought at some stage that, a guy who rode the Giro, well, very briefly, would win the stage today. When I saw Vlasov go, and it would have been fun, because it looked like, you know, the GC contenders would maybe let him go, but it was not to be. But, you know, there might have been that moment when, you know, a guy who started the Giro winning a stage in the Vuelta would have been fun.
But Carapaz and Roglic do look pretty well matched, don't they? You know, one has a good day, the other has a good day, and there's not a great deal. Even today, when Roglic opened a gap, you know, Carapaz was, still able to limit losses, and it looks like it's going to be like that every time there's an opportunity for them to try and take time. And it will be, certainly for the time being, it will be about seconds, and time bonuses will come into it as well.
Something we haven't said is that final climb was great. I mean, that mano and mano between Roglic and Carapaz, I found very exciting, because they attacked in turn. They seemed to be taking the edge, and then the other countered. I mean, I thought it was really exciting. And the what's even more exciting is that the difference in styles. I mean, Roglic never left, you know, his saddle, and Carapaz was like, you know, not dancing on his pedals, but really going for it. And so the difference in style, the difference in personality. personalities maybe, well, the difference in, you know, I mean, it amounts to an exciting battle if there is to be a battle between these two, but that's what it seems to be the case.
Yeah, I think there's not much to tell between them, is there?
No, I was actually going to mention the climb, because the Alto de Moncalvillo, it's the first time it's been used as a stage finish in the Vuelta, and it was beautiful for a start. It looked really good, and clearly the gradient was there was enough variation in it to really make it a racing climb, and it wasn't so severe that when, for example, Hugh Carthy made that big effort to go off the front, when he was then caught, he was still able to try to go up to, well, he did go up to Roglic and Carapaz, I mean, and then he was a distant a little bit later on, but didn't then lose sackfuls of time, which it wasn't as fearsome a gradient and as one-dimensional as perhaps the Angliru can be, because the thing about the Angliru is that they've really nothing to offer the riders that balance between risk and reward, whereas there was on this climb, because you wouldn't have been throwing everything away if things had gone wrong on the climb. There were opportunities to sort of recover, so it was a real race up that final climb, I thought, which is not something necessarily we see on the Angliru. The Angliru is more of just a selection, one after the other, and we find out who the strongest guys are and what the gaps are in between them. Whereas this really, was uncertain until the last sort of 200-300 metres.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport. Sport, our long-time sponsor. They first backed us at the Giro in 2016. We're very grateful to them for their support. If you would like 25% off all your Science and Sport products, perhaps you're doing some secret Zwifting with Lionel Burney and Rob Hatch, and you want to stock up on your Turbo Plus products with the menthol to keep you cool, and that's the Turbo Plus range, go to scienceandsport.com and enter the code SISCP25. We actually had an email today from Stephen Moon, the chief executive at Science and Sport, a great supporter and a regular correspondent. He says that he was born in Preston. If you ever wondered what my accent was, well, yeah, I mean, I knew that. And Stephen does have a Preston accent. I'm massively appreciative, says Stephen, of Lionel's highlighting of the trailblazing Invincibles. I thought Daniel was a bit sniffy, and it's my belief that he should say the discount code in a Hugh Carthy accent. Well, I went through the Giro trying to get Daniel to remember the SISCP25 code. So we played a little bit of Daniel's interview with Hugh Carthy last night, asking him about Preston's very famous bus station. So we'll ask Daniel if he can do the code in a Hugh Carthy accent. He's very good at accents, actually, so I think he might be able to pull that
We
off.
May have to write the code down for him and show it on FaceTime. I didn't even get to mention that the other thing that I'm very fond of from Preston, which is butter pie, which is not a butter pie, actually. It's a pastry pie with onions and potatoes in. And if there's several bakeries and what have you that specialise in butter pie in Preston and the surrounding area. And whenever I'm up there, because I have family up there, I always get myself a nice big slice of butter pie, as you can imagine, Richard.
I have to ask, Lionel, if it was just butter, I think you'd be quite keen on that as well, no? Tasty butter pie.
I'm sure the onions are fried and softened in butter first. I mean, and the pastry is very buttery.
Butter pie.
Oh, it really is nice. Anyway.
Oh, my mouth's watering.
Yeah, sounds brilliant. I mean, I was wondering when where to go on holidays once we get out of lockdown, and now Preston is my number one choice. Thanks, Lionel.
And yeah, no butter pie gels available at Science and Sport. But thanks again to Science and Sport and to Stephen. Speaking of Preston, I mean, Hugh Carthy mentioned them already. A very, very courageous ride today. Mike Woods, I mean, it was interesting because I watched Valverde go backwards and thought, he's maybe paying for those efforts that he made yesterday, because that was a hard day. And we spoke last night about Valverde riding it in a very cavalier fashion. He was obviously wanting the stage win, but he he will have used a lot of matches. But then, of course, Mike Woods won the stage and presumably used a lot of matches as well. But he was on the front when Valverde was going out the back. And he rode very well to set up Hugh Carthy for an attack with about 3.5 kilometres to go. So it was a long way. But, you know, he was 18 seconds off the jersey, and it was worth a try. I saw on Twitter that his boss at EF Pro Cycling, Jonathan Vauters, said that he thought he'd gone a bit too early. But we get frustrated, don't we, so often when riders don't have a go. And Lizzie Banks was talking about this as well at the Giro. The action was coming at the back of the race, people going out the back rather than at the front. Here, Hugh Carthy really tried to take it on. And the climb, whether it was the climb or whether it was his legs, his form, he was able to just keep coming back when he, you know, started paying for that effort a bit later on. And he didn't lose too much. You know, he's still within a minute on GC. He slipped down a couple of places. But it was worth a go, I think.
Yeah, two things about that, actually. One, you know, the amount of work that Mike Woods did in the kind of the setup. He was on the front for, quite a while, really. And I'm always fascinated by this. Would he have been as willing to do that had he not got his stage win in the bag yesterday? Was it a case of, that success breeding success, almost, you know, the confidence within the team, and obviously Mike Woods' confidence to sting his legs on a day when he could just have done a bit, bit work maybe further down the climb.
Well, he could have won. He could have won the stage
possibly if he hadn't already got one under his belt. So that was really interesting. And then I agree with Jonathan Vauters. I mean, very, very easy watching on TV to think that's too far to go. But 3.5 kilometres would have been a heck of an effort. Maybe he was trying to see if he could slim down the group a bit and reduce his odds and make it a bit simpler towards the top. Who knows? But the fact that he did then get back in once, it was the second time that it all kicked off, really, that he was distanced. And not catastrophically so. As you say, 44 seconds off the red jersey. And I think, anyway, overall victory would probably be a stretch too far. But top five, top three, who knows? I mean, certainly not out of it. And, you know, riding well, riding with confidence. And also another one who had, got through the Tour de France. That would have been both tough but also beneficial, I think.
You say the winning the race might be out of reach, but I really think anything's possible. I mean, okay, Carapaz and Roglic do look superior to the rest, but in this season in particular, it just feels like that the normal rules don't apply, and we've seen it at the Tour de France and at the Giro. And I feel like anything could happen.
Yeah, the problem is that you can get rid maybe of one. Anybody can have a bad day. Roglic already had his, but can you really imagine the three of them, Carapaz, Roglic and Dan Martin, really fighting all in succession? I'm not really sure about that.
Really.
And there was an ominous sign today when Sepp Kuss actually came to bridge the gap, came across to Carthy and kind of at first I thought he was going for the stage win with Carthy, and he was about to be kind of the Jai Hindley to Kelderman doing the same thing with for Roglic. But obviously there was already a Roglic plan cooking there, and he did a great job, and already you could tell that the two main contenders in that Vuelta were waiting for the last 2Ks to do their show. So I as much as I like the way Carthy rides, as much as I like the character, for me, from what we've seen so far, I think that the three guys ahead of him are probably a little bit better still.
Just lastly on Carthy, Rich, I don't know what you think, but I mean, he does seem to ride a bigger gear than, he's not a twiddler, is he, like Roglic? And I do think that might be problematic on the Angliru, where, it really is about, there's an element of souplesse and force in all climbing, isn't there? It's a combination, and you have to be able to do a bit of both. But that might be tricky when it's absolutely super steep. I'm falling into Lizzie Banks pro cyclist talk here. Is super steep, but
the great thing about this is that when he wins on the Angleroo, we can play this bit back.
Looking back at last year's Giro, if you remember, Roglic won the time trial at San Marino, and at the time we thought, well, it's in the bag. Roglic is going to win the Giro because he wasn't in the pink jersey, was he? But he was the best of the GC riders. Hugh Carthy was 8th on that stage, 1 minute 30 behind Roglic, and Carapaz was 11th on the stage, 1 minute 55 behind Roglic. Now, of course, we know Carapaz won the Giro in the end. So, you know, again, wondering about the time trial stage next week, which is kind of rolling, flattish rolling, but then has the climb up at the end. So I wouldn't think Carthy's got anything to particularly worry about there. But like I say, well, yes, clip this out. I do worry about the Angleroo for him on Sunday.
Someone who's ridden very well on the Angleroo, Wout Poels, rode well today. He's sort of coming back from a slow start. But I'm taking us off on a tangent there, because I think we're going to hear, aren't we, from Hugh Carthy's teammate Mitch Docker, who's going to be keeping us in the loop or updated with little dispatches from the race.
Yeah,
they had a stage win yesterday, of course, with Mike Woods, and he sent in a little dispatch this morning, didn't he?
Yes, what an amazing day for us yesterday. To be honest, I had nothing to do with that victory, but it's weird with this sport and with cycling, you still feel that victory because it's not only the day performance that goes into it, it's the whole tour. It's, you know, the days leading up to it, it's also in the bus, it's around the dinner table, the atmosphere that's created. And I think everyone feels this victory, a team victory, when someone like Woodsy, he was in the break with Magnus. So those two worked together and ultimately he won that solo. So it was a really great feeling after a really tough start to this race. I know I've been alluding to that the whole time in each of my voice messages, but it has been a tough start. And we're only 7 days deep. And every day is being ridden really like, maybe not exactly like a one-day race, but pretty hard. We've got another hard one today and another big weekend coming up. So to have a little bit of success in the middle of all this is just like a breath of fresh air. And personally, I think for Mike Woods, what I feel, I was so happy for him to get that victory because Woodsy's worked so hard to come back this year. He had his big accident, breaking his femur in Paris-Nice earlier this year. Throughout the whole lockdown in Europe, he recovered. He did all his recovery and got himself back to where he needed to be. He missed out on the Tour de France selection. He was just off the mark in some of those classics and the Worlds. He was there, but he just wasn't quite there. He never really got that result that sort of capped off all the effort and hard work he'd put in. The other day he got second in the stage. It was just like bittersweet. And to see him get that victory yesterday, I thought, wow, he deserved that. He's worked hard for it and he really did deserve it. And the way that he won it, beating, you know, Valverde, the green bullet, he's in form and he was firing. And if you can get one over Valverde, you know you're going very well. So all in all, the team is in a really good position with Hugh Carthy sitting in second on GC. So there's great morale in the team. You know, we've got a lot of things to focus on, which makes it a lot easier in a big grand tour. We've got a lot of purpose in the race and yeah, it sort of flipped things around with that victory from Woodsy right in the middle of the tour. Well, yeah, almost in the middle where things start to get hard, a bit grippy and, the champagne slipped down very well last night.
Well, we announced quite recently that we have a new partnership with Laka, who have been advertising in the podcast for a few years now. We've got a very good relationship with them. They're the bike insurance people, a community of cyclists, and it's a very interesting, innovative model they have. We know lots of our listeners are Laka customers. Your premiums are go up and down depending on how many other claims there have been. And Laka were so sort of encouraged by how many Cycling Podcast listeners had signed up, that they have set up a community within LACA community of cycling podcast listeners. If you would like to sign up and join that community, if you do so, you will be supporting the cycling podcast. Anyone who has signed up in the last couple of years using the cycling podcast code will automatically be part of this community. By the way, we have been asked that by a couple of people. So if you'd like to sign up or find out more, go to LACA, LAKA.co.uk and use the code TCP, and that will get you some LACA bike insurance and put you in the cycling podcast community.
Yeah, and LACA is also doing a crowdfunding effort to raise money for the next step in their development. And if you want to invest in LACA, they're offering some equity for that investment. So not only is the model of insurance a collective cooperative effort, but they're offering people the chance to get involved in owning a little bit of LACA. So you can invest in the future of the company from as little as £10. To find out more, again, go to LACA.co.uk. That's LAKA.co.uk.
Lionel, do you want to take us on a slight tangent? Because you mentioned earlier about how easy it is to, from the comfort of your sofa in Not Watford, you know, say how riders should ride and so on, and when they should make their attacks. Paul Hayward, the great sports writer, former chief sports writer at The Telegraph, found himself in a dispute on Twitter, or a disagreement on Twitter, with the Irish rugby legend Brian O'Driscoll. They disagreed on something, and when Hayward saw that that O'Driscoll had a different view, he tweeted, It's slightly unfortunate for me that you have four Lions tours, 133 Ireland caps, three European Cups and the Six Nations try scoring record to support your view of it, while I have a beer and a remote control." It's a wonderful display of humility. Nothing whatsoever to do with cycling or the Vuelta, but we can all learn from Paul Hayward, I think, when we find ourselves in a debate with someone on Twitter.
To be honest, though, anyway, Rich, no, I mean, just to follow on that, you know, in what we do, I mean, you've made this point to me before about how when we're trying to unpick what happened in the stage, you know, we're seeing as much of the picture as the TV offers us, or as the riders explain to us, and so, you know, we can only really guess at motivations. I mean, Hugh Carthy, when he made that move, he might have been feeling absolutely fantastic and thinking, no, I can do this from here. I mean, the analysis that we can do only goes so far, really, doesn't it? I mean, at the end, we all see the results, and we all look for those little signs of who was making good decisions, who was making bad. But every single stage of every race is, you know, there's millions of individual decisions being made, and it's impossible to sort of fit them all together and say, well, this happened and then that happened because this happened and so on.
There's a very famous quote by Jacques Anquetil. One day he was interviewed by a journalist, and the journalist said, "So Jacques, how did it go today?" And he said, "Well, read L'Equipe tomorrow and Pierre Chani will tell you, you know, because I mean Chani was the star writer of L'Equipe at the time for cycling." And so many times Anquetil was saying, I mean, when I read Chani's stuff, it's much better than what I felt, you know. So so in a way that works. And there was a little dispute, to go back to the Giro dispute with the riders. There were a few French riders who tweeted that, you know, people who disavowed the movement, that they've never been on a bike. And some guys replied, very few political journalists have been presidents, you know. So there you are. I mean, that's to stay on the same wavelength.
Absolutely. I think, yeah, I mean, that's the beauty of cycling, that actually the guys in the race sometimes have the worst view of the race. And I know from going back and looking at previous races, you know, when I did Sling the Badger, I remember Greg LeMond and Andy Hampson both saying that they learned a lot from other people's accounts of races that they'd been in that they just didn't know about. And so that happens a lot in cycling.
Can I have my little French corner? Because I started to that little French corner yesterday with talking about Guillaume Martin.
I like this. Are we going to do this every time, Francois? I like a little French corner.
Yeah. And so Guillaume Martin today was not at his best. He was dropped in the final climb, but he managed to retain his polka dot jersey. But it was a young guy, there was a young guy finishing 10th called Clément Champoussin. He's 22, which is very old by today's standards. And is a guy to look forward to, because one of the many guys from that generation, because he was 5th in the Tour de l'Avenir 2018 and 4th in 2019. And I had some comments from my good friend Stéphane Goubert, who's the editor à la Mondiale DS at La Vuelta, and he said that Champoussin is in his first Grand Tour. He's from Nice, and he didn't have chance to ride a Grand Tour before. But Champoussin told him that in the under 23 ranks, he was riding alongside guys like Bernard or Pogacar and being on par with these guys. So he asked the editor team, give me my chance. I mean, these guys are up there, and I'm still in kind of waiting for my day. And Goubert was saying that he was confessing that there was a kind of a way of thinking in kind of an old school way of thinking among French teams and traditional directeur sportif, that you should spare a rider until he's 27, 28. I know we had that debate when Bernal emerged in the Tour in the past, and Goubert was saying that he was wrong. They were probably wrong. It was probably the what they've been doing with Gaudu or waiting for him to kind of mature and come of age was probably wrong. And he said that these days
Gaudu.
Yeah, waiting for Goody was probably a bad idea, and you should now give these guys their chance. And that's what they've been trying to do with Champoussin. They told him, go for it in the last climb, and well, he finished 10th, doing pretty well, and probably, gaining confidence for the future. And so it's a little bit of a change of approach to the sport, and now all these young guys are showing that the prime of a pro rider that was supposed to be 27, 28 is probably much earlier now. So I thought it was my little French corner interesting.
He really caught the eye, if only because, he was the one rider there he didn't really know an awful lot about. If you look at the names around about him, Valverde, Nieve, Bennett, Guillaume Martin finished just behind him. So he really did catch the eye, and that was a very, very strong performance from him that he will take a lot of confidence from.
He had a dig, didn't he, on the day that Dan Martin won on the final climb. He was off the front briefly and finished 10th that day as well. So, clearly going to be somebody who's up there on the climbs and putting together a decent Grand Tour debut.
Let's hear, shall we, from one of our diarists, Nick Schultz of Mitchelton Scott, who did a good job today for his team leader Esteban Chavez, though Chavez lost a little bit of ground today. He actually moved up a place overall. He's up to 7th. But Nick Schultz was there on the climb to support him.
Stage 8. Another hard day. Keeping with tradition in this Vuelta so far. Another battle for the break. Not quite as long as the other days. I was up there sniffing around, trying to find that elusive move. But couldn't find it again, but we had young Rob Stannard get up there for us, which was good. It just takes the pressure off the team for further on in the stage if anything was to happen, or the break's going to go for the victory. We've got someone there for the opportunity, so that was really good. And then back in the bunch, it was all hands on deck to support Esteban and Mikel on the first climb of the day. Movistar started riding, quite clearly stating their intent at going for the stage win. There was a bit of wind around on the climb, so things got pretty heated pretty quickly, and it was a very sort of stressful and quick run into the final climb, which was a savage climb, actually, but really beautiful area. I don't think I've really been in that part of the world before, but it was lovely, and we had amazing weather today, really amazing views throughout the climb, of which we don't really get to enjoy that much. But yeah, on the climb, just sort of hanging on there for as long as I could, just in case something would happen to Esteban or Mikel in that first section of the climb. But luckily for us, that didn't, and they were able to do the climb as planned, and Esteban's still looking very good, just a little bit off those top guys, but it's a long way to the end of the race, and we'll just keep chipping away and taking it day by day and looking for those opportunities. But so far, so good.
Well, let's hear from another of our audio diarists, shall we? Nick Dlamini from NTT Pro Cycling has been keeping us updated with his progress at the Vuelta, and he's just sent in his latest dispatch after stage 8.
Hi guys, yeah, I'm really sorry for the last couple of days. I just got caught up with the massage and the late finishes. Yeah, it slipped off my mind. But just a quick update. Yeah, the rest day actually was really chilled. It was super relaxed. We went out for a nice easy spin. So we got to do the first 20Ks of stage 7. So we got to see the first part on our rest day. And it was pretty relaxed. The legs honestly just felt like bricks on rest day. They were really sore. But the morning after, they felt much better. But stage 7 was really hard. You know, I think everyone was really fresh, batteries recharged, you know. And also knowing that it's a day for breakaway, everyone just wanted to be in the breakaway. So that obviously calls for hard racing, you know, just like a million attacks going. And and we eventually had a breakaway up the road. Nice enough that we had Stefan de Bart in there. And it was really good. Sort of, it was nice having his presence in the breakaway. And obviously today was also quite a hard day. Day for breakaway, but it was actually not as bad as the other days. It was obviously kind of always on the pedals, not really easy. But much better than the other days. And looking forward to tomorrow's stage, which is probably a band sprint, so that should be a good one.
Well, chaps, we should wrap things up for another night. We'll be back tomorrow. We may have a bit tomorrow from the Giro winner, Theo Gegenhart. I'm speaking to him tomorrow afternoon. That'll be for a much longer episode for friends of the podcast, but we might play a little clip in tomorrow night's episode, assuming that all goes according to plan. Before we go, we should say a big thank you to friends of the podcast, those of you who have signed up to be a friend of the podcast. We've got some great episodes coming up, we're very grateful to you for your support. From me, a big thanks to Christopher Mahon, Nigel Bosley, Mr. Alex Healy, Sam Leader, Sam Radakovich, John McDonald, and Andrew Palfrey.
And a big thank you to Jonathan Twigg, Joe Hortua, Kevin Jones, Mark Kerfey, John Scale, Sean McRobert, and Keith Protheroe.
And a grand merci to Nick Plain, Michael Charneski, Andrew Wright, Lee Statham, Nathan Carden, Duncan Murray, and Richard Coffey.
And also, just finally, a big thanks to Hayden Wood and Dan Wood, father and son, who listened to the podcast. I had an email from Dan today. Can't really reveal what that's about. It's a surprise for his father. So hello and thank you to Hayden Wood and Dan Wood.
Well, off for a glass of Rioja. I wish I was standing in the Cala Laurel in Logroño, leaning on one of the old wine, the oak barrels that they
munching on a butter pie and sipping
there.
A glass of Rioja.
I think they go well together. I really do.
The Rioja just cut through the butter. I made pumpkin and sweet potato curry this afternoon while I was watching the Vuelta. Very nice. We've got a lot of pumpkins. Okay. If anyone out there would like a pumpkin, just send a box to me, Richard Moore, Picardy, and I'll send one back to you.